Adrian Lamo seems to have fallen asleep. His head hangs suspended over his lunch, a plate of salmon, plantains, and vegetables, next to a cup of coffee that he has filled to the brim with cream and 5 packets of sugar. We're sitting in a restaurant that serves Colombian food, a few blocks from his home in a dreary town that he's requested I not name. Instead, the 30-year-old hacker has asked me to write only that we met on an island, a taunting clue to the legions of angry supporters of WikiLeaks and Bradley Manning who would like to locate Lamo and harass or harm him. Those pursuers aren't a figment of Lamo's imagination. Just days before, a news crew from Al Jazeera posted a TV interview of Lamo that included a momentary shot of his computer. One of his many online stalkers quickly spotted an internet protocol address on the screen, performed a whois lookup to find a registered location in Carmichael, California, and posted screenshots of the information online. Luckily for Lamo, it was an old address. Still, Lamo hasn't shaken his paranoid compulsions, partly residual from his years as a hacker and homeless drifter. When we sit down at the restaurant, he insists on switching seats to face the door, despite the fact that both of our seats are perpendicular to the exit. The question that seems, a few minutes into our meal, to have had such a soporific effect on Lamo is this one. Now that Bradley Manning has been placed in an isolated cell in a Quantico, Virginia brig awaiting trial, largely deprived of exercise and visitors, and forced to strip and wear nothing but a coarse smock every night to prevent him from committing suicide with his underwear's elastic band, does Lamo regret having turned Manning over to authorities? Looking back, would he still have drawn him out in online conversations that stretched over days as Manning confessed every detail of his leaks and then turned those incriminating logs over to the authorities? Lamo has responded by closing his eyes and allowing his head to bob and sink slowly for several seconds. I consider reaching over to tap him on the shoulder. Before I do, he suddenly looks up and answers me. The man is the equivalent of a spy. He's our next Aldrich Ames or Robert Hansen, Lamo says, naming 2 convicted double agents who sold information to the USSR over several decades. Lamo's speech is a robotic slur, a result of the cocktail of psychoactive prescription drugs he takes daily. But his hazel eyes have opened wide, and he's now staring at me with surprising lucidity. The only difference is that instead of giving information to the Soviets, he's giving it to an anti-secrecy organization. In another country, he'd get a bullet in the head. Here, he gets donations and approbation. Lamo's hair is slicked back away from his pudgy, almost feminine baby face. In his pierced left earlobe is a small screw he wears as an earring. He wears a blue shirt tucked into his jeans over a potbelly that's likely another side effect of his medical regimen. Earlier, Lamo listed 5 names of drugs he says he takes to treat his Asperger's syndrome, a form of autism. But when I consult with a doctor after our meeting, I learn that the drugs are generally used for treating chronic pain, depression, and schizophrenia. There is no prescription drug for the treatment of Asperger's. Lamo goes on to argue that the story of Manning's mistreatment comes from just the few supporters that have managed to visit him. Manning's friend David House and his lawyer, David Combs. Manning is being treated as any maximum security detainee would be treated, Lamo slurs. It's being played up as a sideshow to garner sympathy. But House and Combs aren't the only ones to point out Manning's mistreatment. Just the week before, P.J. Crowley, the State Department public affairs official, called Manning's treatment by the military ridiculous, counterproductive, and stupid, before resigning his government post. Later, a UN torture investigator would also speak out after being barred from visiting Manning. The waitress comes over, and Lamo, who spent part of his childhood in Colombia, makes her laugh with a few words in slurred Spanish. Then he takes a sip of coffee, but his mouth doesn't seem to function properly, and he moves the liquid around in his cheeks for several seconds before swallowing. I continue, doesn't it open Lamo to charges of hypocrisy that he turned Manning in for the same information wants to be free attitude that Lamo himself preached during his years as an illegal hacker? Lamo looks down into his plate, closes his eyes, and his neck muscles seem to relax. After a few seconds, I fear again that he's finally passed out in his chair. When he looks up suddenly, this time I twitch in surprise. "I know that saying this isn't going to make me very many friends," Lamo says. "But had Manning released just that video and nothing else, I wouldn't have told anyone about it. I would have even exfiltrated it myself if I were him." Lamo pauses, as if to let this sink in. "He should have gone through the files," he continues. "Instead, he said, 'Here are 1,000,000 documents. I've read 1/1,000,000th of a percent of them, but I've established there's no harm in releasing them.'" Lamo goes through a convoluted arithmetic he says he used to make his decision. First, weighing the good of the victims of the helicopter strike and their families versus the good of the soldiers who carried out that strike. And then the good of Manning versus that of the secrecy of the entire United States military and State Department. And since the moment that he committed to handing over his instant messenger chat logs to the authorities, Lamo says he hasn't doubted the conclusions of his moral calculus. Lamo's lids fall to half-mast. "He wanted to make the world a better place. He just didn't know what he was doing," he intones flatly. "I wish there could have been some other resolution. I actually suggested to the agents that they keep him around and feed him disinformation. Instead, they chose to grab him." This is the stranger of all possible strangers to whom Bradley Manning chose to confess a leak that may put him in prison for the rest of his life. When Manning sought out Lamo as a confessor and friend, he had some reason to believe that the older hacker was a kindred spirit. For several years at the beginning of the last decade, Lamo was one of the media's favorite digital deviants, the so-called homeless hacker. Traveling back and forth across the United States by Greyhound, fueled by amphetamines and painkillers, sleeping in abandoned buildings and on friends' floors, Lamo would stop into 24-hour Kinko's to use their computers for marathon hacking sessions. Lamo avoided traditional network intrusion, which uses unpatched vulnerabilities in the victim's software. Instead, he often exploited misconfigured proxy servers, meant for use by outsourcing firms and other corporate partners, as hidden gaps in corporate firewalls. Using Internet Explorer as his only tool, Lamo would pry open those gaps and enter forbidden networks. Once, he tells me, he could have transferred the entire cash pool set aside for bonuses at the telecom giant MCI WorldCom to any account he chose. On another occasion, he found a bug in AOL's network that allowed hackers to hijack users' instant messenger accounts. And he later hacked a Yahoo website to insert a dig at President Bush into a news story. He carried a stun gun on his travels and used it for electrocuting various objects like electronic locks and vending machines, which sometimes responded by spitting out change or food. In 2002, Lamo dug up a flaw in the New York Times corporate password system and exploited it to add his name to the paper's list of op-ed contributors, beside the former head of the NSA, Robert Redford, and Rush Limbaugh. On that same field trip inside the Times network, he also used the paper's account to run the equivalent of $300,000 in searches on the paid research service LexisNexis. Lamo made a point of minimizing the damage from his hacks and alerting the administrators of the systems he exploited, going so far as to walk them through the necessary steps to close their security holes. But in the case of the Times adventure, Lamo's victim didn't see his intrusion as a favor. The company turned his case over to the FBI, which put out a warrant for his arrest and tracked the 22-year-old's itinerant wandering for 5 days before he surrendered himself to police in Sacramento. After a year-long trial, Lamo pled guilty and was sentenced to pay $65,000 in fines and spend 6 months under house arrest at his parents' home. After the New York Times case, Lamo became a poster boy for the well-intentioned hacker misunderstood by society. He starred as the central character in a documentary film titled Hackers Wanted that focused on his mistreatment at the hands of the federal law enforcement. In the final message of that film, Lamo gives a soliloquy on digital ethics that transcend what's legal or illegal, delivered at fast-forward pace that sounds nothing like his drug-swamped speech today. I hoped and believed that I could hack systems in a way that would set a precedent that would allow people to come forward in good faith to try to do the right thing, to let them believe that maybe motives did matter, that it wasn't all black and white. I think this is symptomatic of something we're seeing in the government today. In many ways, they're eliminating shades of gray. They want to polarize people. It's important to our national agenda today to see good guys and bad guys. Because as soon as we start to believe that maybe it's not all black and white, that someone can do wrong for a good reason, that not every action of law is inherently infallible, it strikes a very dangerous precedent for the government the way it wants to operate today. After the documentary's filming was completed in 2003, Hackers Wanted went unreleased for 7 years until it was finally leaked in May of 2010 onto copyright-flouting BitTorrent file-sharing networks, where it became a modest hit in the world of hackers and information security. Lamo insists he wasn't the source of the leak. When fans wrote to Lamo and the film's director, Sam Bazzo, asking how they could support the film with donations, Lamo wrote on his Twitter feed on May 20th that donors should give their money instead to WikiLeaks, the whistleblower organization that 1 month before had released Manning's Apache helicopter video to an explosive response. For a young, conscience-stricken soldier who had just completed a massive leak of secret documents, everything would have pointed to Lamo as a sympathetic confidant. Just a day later, Lamo says he began receiving emails from Bradley Manning. The text of the messages was encrypted, and the public key encryption Manning had used was designed so that only Lamo could decrypt it. But Lamo couldn't find the key that would unlock those messages, so they remained hopelessly scrambled. Lamo wrote back suggesting they simply chat over Instant Messenger. On May 21st, Lamo received the following message, this time encrypted using the off-the-record chat protocol. "Hi, how are you? I'm an Army intelligence analyst deployed to Eastern Baghdad pending discharge for adjustment disorder. I'm sure you're pretty busy." The message from a user named Bradass87 read. And then, before even waiting for a response, it continued, "If you had unprecedented access to classified networks 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, for 8+ months, what would you do?" After a year of shuttling briefcases of documents out of Rand and standing over photocopiers for nights on end, Ellsberg was ready to spill the Pentagon Papers. His next problem, finding someone to take them. Ellsberg's plan A was to have a legislator read the papers into the congressional record or hold a hearing based on them, an avenue to the public that still played within Washington's rules. But Ellsberg's first choice in the Senate, William Fulbright, balked. After some initial enthusiasm, Fulbright read a portion of the documents and performed a swift about-face after he realized just what kind of political maelstrom might surround the report's release. "Isn't it, after all, only history?" he asked Ellsberg dismissively when they next met in his office. Ellsberg moved on to the Democratic presidential hopeful, Senator George McGovern, who at first seemed even more gung-ho about airing the papers. McGovern offered to read the study on the Senate floor as filibustering material, which would make it fair game for the media. "I want to do it. I will do it," Ellsberg remembers the Democratic legislator declaring in their meeting. A week later, he called Ellsberg on the phone. "I'm sorry, I can't do it," McGovern said. His campaign for the presidency, it seemed, would have been hamstrung by the controversy of a political pipe bomb like Ellsberg's leak. So Ellsberg turned to Plan B, A whistleblowing outlet, he felt, was almost sure to result in his spending many years in prison. The press. A few years earlier, Ellsberg had experimented with several single document leaks to the New York Times aimed at chipping away at Vietnam policy. So he knew a political reporter there, Neil Sheehan. Ellsberg had moved to Cambridge after resigning from Rand to protect his former colleagues from whatever backlash might follow the paper's leak. And in his apartment near Harvard Square, he showed Sheehan a copy of his stolen bounty. Sheehan took a portion with him, but told Ellsberg his editors still hadn't decided whether to go ahead with publication. In fact, Sheehan's pretense of dallying over the study was designed to prevent the Times from being scooped by another publication. A few weeks later, Sheehan used a key Ellsberg had loaned him to sneak into the Cambridge apartment, have the papers photocopied in a nearby shop, and return them. The newspaper had already rented out a portion of the New York Hilton and begun frantically, secretly, building its story on the study. On January 13, 1971, the story splashed across the front page of the Times. Vietnam Archive. Pentagon study traces 3 decades of growing U.S. involvement. And how long did it take for the leak to be traced to Ellsberg? In fact, some Rand analysts already suspected him even before the Times presses started rolling. The newspaper had called Rand executive Leslie Gelb to give him a chance to comment on the story. And according to Ellsberg biographer Tom Wells, Gelb immediately fixated on Ellsberg as the source. How many high-level analysts, after all, had both access to the papers and such a fierce opposition to the war? The White House didn't take long to finger Ellsberg either. In archived White House recordings, Nixon names Ellsberg and Rand executives Mort Halperin and Leslie Gelb as the only 3 analysts who had access to the study. Within days, Ellsberg, or Elstein, as Nixon called him with crude anti-Semitic humor, was being discussed as the assumed perpetrator of the leak. When the Times hit newsstands, it immediately launched a free speech battle that would redefine the First Amendment. The White House, arguing that the Times had violated the Espionage Act, successfully convinced a federal court to file an injunction against the newspaper to prevent it from publishing any articles on the study. But Ellsberg had already given another copy to the Washington Post, which picked up where the Times left off. The Post was injuncted too, but Ellsberg stayed a step ahead of the government censors, distributing copies of the study to the Boston Globe, the LA Times, the Christian Science Monitor, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and others, avoiding wiretapped phones and staying in friends' houses to dodge arrest until all the papers could be distributed. Faced with an endless game of injunction whack-a-mole, the White House would eventually give up on preventing the paper's publication. Meanwhile, any illusion Ellsberg may have had of remaining anonymous quickly collapsed. A legislative aide to McGovern and Senator Pete McCloskey, another senator who had rebuffed Ellsberg's leak offer, both told Newsweek that Ellsberg had offered them classified documents. The FBI soon extracted an affidavit from Ellsberg's ex-wife, whom he'd told about the leak, to prepare her for the possibility that he would soon be in prison and unable to pay alimony. In exchange for a grant of immunity, Tony Russo's advertising friend, the one who had offered Ellsberg her photocopier, testified to the Bureau's agents too. Every element of Ellsberg's leak, from his access to narrowly shared information to that information's copying to its distribution to countless reporters, had left fingerprints for the feds. The press certainly had no doubts. By the time that Ellsberg turned himself in to federal authorities in Boston, Time magazine had already put his face on its cover below the words, "The War Exposed." With no anonymity tools or cryptographic protections at his disposal, the whistleblower had also exposed himself. In Baghdad's forward operating base, Hammer, where Manning was stationed as an intelligence analyst, security was shockingly lax. Physically, technically, and culturally, as Manning would tell Lamo. He sat among rows of other young analysts watching car chases, music videos, clips of buildings exploding, and often writing data to CDs and DVDs. Even the locks on the doors weren't properly implemented. Though they were secured with electronic codes, soldiers would simply knock and be let in. The culture fed opportunities, he wrote. And then there were the networks. Although CipherNet wasn't connected to the internet, it lacked sophisticated monitoring. Manning would tell Lamo that he once asked an NSA agent at the base if the network was capable of detecting local suspicious activity. Manning says the agent responded that it wasn't a priority and returned to watching the Shia LaBeouf film Eagle Eye and eating Girl Scout cookies. On another occasion, Manning says he asked the agent specifically about a hypothetical mass internal leak. Manning says the agent responded that he doubted anyone could figure it out. Resources are strained. Weak servers, weak logging, weak physical security, weak counterintelligence, inattentive signal analysis, Manning listed to Lamo. It was, all told, a perfect example of how not to do InfoSec. In a Senate hearing in early 2011, Senator Susan Collins would grill military and State Department officials over those exact vulnerabilities. How could it be that a low-level member of the military could download such a volume of documents without it being detected for so long? She asks in a slow, exasperated tone. That truly baffles me. Thomas Ferguson, the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, answers her, sounding distinctly like the teacher's pet who finds himself in the assistant principal's office. The situation in the theater was such that we took a risk. The gray-goateed official responds flatly, trying to get his confessional over with as quickly as possible. We took a risk that by putting information out there to provide agility and flexibility of the military forces there, they would be able to reach into any database on CipherNet, download that information, and move that information using removable media. And why weren't there at least network forensics to catch Manning after his epic data dump? Here, the heat can almost be felt building under Ferguson's collar. A lot of the systems there are, for lack of a technical term, cobbled together, he continues with a tight chest. It's not just like Bank of America, where it's one homogeneous system and they can insert things and take them out. They have multiple systems, and putting in new intrusion software or monitoring tools, you have to approach each system differently. The military, he adds, took on the risk. These people are cleared. They go through background investigations. And then finally, the remarkably honest kicker. Frankly, most of our focus was on the outside intruder threat, not the inside threat. Manning, by all indications, was the quintessential insider threat, and he fluidly negotiated the network's vulnerabilities. In fact, until he sent his fateful encrypted missive to Adrian Lamo, he performed most of his epic data breach as if he were following a leaker's best practices handbook. As Manning told Lamo, the two CipherNet machines that linked to troves of classified information lacked most of the forensic monitoring tools that might have detected his abnormal searches and his repeated copying of that data to his camouflaged rewritable disks. But even after collecting that contraband, Manning didn't dare leak it over internet-connected military networks to WikiLeaks. The timing of his leak suggests he waited until he was able to return to the United States on leave and upload it from his MacBook's connection to a non-military network, perhaps from his aunt's house in Rockville, Maryland. Like Ellsberg, in other words, he walked his leak out through the Pentagon's front door. From there, Manning described to Lamo how he used a combination of security tools to cover every link in the leaking chain that led from WikiLeaks to his MacBook. He connected to WikiLeaks web servers that deployed Secure Sockets Layer, or SSL, the web encryption commonly used to hide e-commerce or banking sites' data from any network snoops looking for passwords or credit card numbers. Then he used Secure Shell File Transfer Protocol, or SSH FTP, a method of creating a tunnel of encryption between two remote systems to allow them to securely share files. Finally, and most significantly, he ran Tor, an anonymity tool that took his path to WikiLeaks' drop site through a series of hops around the internet, each new address in the series encrypted to prevent anyone from piecing together his final destination and his origin. With that hidden, trace-resistant connection set up, Manning proceeded to siphon out the military's secrets through Tor's tangle of obfuscating blind alleys around the world and out to the WikiLeaks server at a data center in Stockholm, Sweden. A year later, after Manning's loose lips had led military investigators to his name, they confiscated every machine that might have been involved in his leak, from the Cypernet computers to the MacBook that had by then been shipped back to his aunt's home in Maryland. With access to those specific computers, the game was over. Investigators found plenty of evidence stored on his hard drives to tie Manning to the leak. He had attempted to expunge all the evidence on his MacBook by overwriting the files with junk data, but his laptop had somehow aborted the process. There were Guantanamo detainee files, 10,000 State Department cables, and, significantly, chat logs between Manning and Julian Assange, in which Assange seemed to help Manning crack into an administrator's account to access the military network while covering his tracks. Assange had wanted to know as little about Manning as possible, and their communications likely remained pseudonymous. "Lie to me," he had told Manning. Investigators even found a README file on Manning's MacBook that he had submitted to WikiLeaks along with his MegaLeak. "This is possibly one of the more significant documents of our time. Removing the fog of war, revealing the true nature of 21st century asymmetric warfare," it read. "Have a good day." But it's important to remember that none of those fingerprints initially led the investigators to Manning's name. Adrian Lamo, not digital detective work, put the army on Manning's scent. All appearances indicate a forensic trail from WikiLeaks to Manning's identity was never found. Before Lamo handed the investigators Manning's name on a platter, they could hardly have confiscated every machine on Cypernet, not to mention every possible laptop used by every intelligence officer on leave in every home in America. Manning, after all, was just another of the 1.2 million Americans with a top-secret security clearance, a well-concealed needle in the towering military-industrial haystack. All of which means that if the young Army private hadn't detailed his entire leaking process to a stranger he had met online just minutes before, step by incriminating step, he might never have been found out. Ellsberg's leak was such a blow to President Nixon's ego and sense of executive power that the White House overreacted in spectacular fashion.
"God damn it! Someone has to go to jail!"
Nixon was recorded saying, pounding on his desk with a fist.
"That's all there is to it!"
Later, the administration's attack methods broadened. "We've got to get him," the president said to Kissinger and Attorney General John Mitchell, referring to Ellsberg.
"Don't worry about his trial. Just get everything out. Try him in the press. We want to destroy him in the press. Is that clear?"
What came next must be considered some of the most absurd and shameful tactics in presidential history. One group of Nixon's operatives followed Ellsberg's psychotherapist, Louis Fielding, disguised with wigs, pipes, and, for one agent, a shoe insert to create a fake limp. Later, they broke into Fielding's office to dig up Ellsberg's records. The burglars hoped to find dirt on his personal life, or even a connection to a foreign government or subversive group. They found nothing. Fielding hadn't stored any notes on Ellsberg in his office. The break-in was followed by an attempt to drug Ellsberg with LSD before a speech he planned to give in Washington. Cuban hotel workers in Miami were recruited by a team led by G. Gordon Liddy to infiltrate the event, spike Ellsberg's soup with acid to befuddle him, and make him appear to be a near-burnt-out drug case. But by the time it was all approved, the Miami waiters couldn't be flown to Washington in time. The plan was scrapped. In the Watergate trial, prosecutors would find that a team of 12 Cuban men had also been hired to assault and totally incapacitate Ellsberg at a peace rally. Members of that team later said their mission had been variously to punch Ellsberg in the face or break his legs. But the crowd around the newly famous whistleblower had been too thick, and the 12 goons decided to instead beat up random, unlucky protesters at the event's edges. Much of that criminal behavior didn't become public until after Ellsberg's trial. But in the meantime, Ellsberg's defense team found that investigators had illegally wiretapped Ellsberg and Rand's Mort Halperin without a court order, and even worse, neglected to share those files with the defense. Finally, the judge in the case, William Byrne, revealed that he had been approached by a Nixon aide and offered nothing less than the directorship of the FBI in exchange for influence in the Ellsberg trial. That mountain of improprieties added up to a mistrial. The totality of the circumstances of this case offend a sense of justice, wrote Byrne in his decision. The bizarre events have incurably infected the prosecution of this case. Ellsberg was free. The same day, newspapers reported that Nixon's Attorney General John Mitchell, who had indicted Ellsberg, had himself been indicted on charges of conspiracy, obstruction of justice, and perjury. It was the beginning of the end of the Nixon presidency, and eventually, the war in Vietnam. When Manning and Lamo first began their exchange of encrypted messages, Lamo made two promises of confidentiality. "I'm a journalist and a minister," he told Manning. "You can pick either and treat this as a confession or an interview, never to be published, and enjoy a modicum of legal protection." In fact, within 48 hours of first contact with Bradley Manning, Lamo says he was already mulling the possibility of turning his newfound friend in to authorities. He contacted Tim Webster, a former Army counterintelligence agent and friend, and later Chet Huber, an ex-intelligence contractor who worked with Lamo in a volunteer cybersecurity research group called Project Vigilant. Webster put Lamo in contact with Army counterintelligence officers who soon telephoned him at his home. They were skeptical and asked for proof of Lamo's claims. It hardly seemed credible that a private first class had accessed and stolen gigabytes of some of the world's most sensitive information and then confessed it casually over instant messenger to a stranger. Lamo says he responded by referring to a code-named secret project that Manning had mentioned to him. There was a long silence. Then one of the agents asked Lamo never to repeat that code name. "They told me to forget that I'd ever heard the word," he says. The feds didn't question Lamo's credibility again. The call with the Criminal Investigation Division, CID, led to a meeting with FBI agents. Huber would remember that at this point, Lamo was conflicted and even called Huber in the middle of his sit-down with the G-Men. "I'm in a meeting with five guys, and I don't want to do this," Huber says Lamo told him. The older man says he responded, "You don't have any choice. You've got to do this." For the next 2 days, Lamo continued to chat with Manning, now with the knowledge that federal agents would be looking over his shoulder at their conversation. They discussed religion, Lamo's legal history, and the crazy white-haired Australian Julian Assange, with whom Manning had been communicating. At one point, Manning began to wax lyrical about the victims and perpetrators of the Apache helicopter video he had helped to expose, which WikiLeaks had used to send shockwaves around the world just a month before. Manning mentioned that he'd recently added several of the people involved as friends on Facebook. Those individuals included 33-year-old ex-soldier Ethan McCord, who had been racked with guilt over his involvement in the highly publicized Apache helicopter attack and would later speak out against the war. "They touch my life, I touch their life, they touch my life again. Full circle," Manning wrote. "Life's funny," Lamo responded. Then Lamo abruptly changed the subject. "Are you concerned about Army counterintelligence looking into your Wiki stuff?" he asked. "I was always paranoid." Manning responded that there was no open investigation, a sign that he had likely been doing some investigations of his own, counterintelligence. In later conversations, Manning went on to describe how all records of his leak had been zero-filled, irreversibly deleted, and to describe the arsenal of anonymity and privacy tools he had used. Lamo asked him what he would do if his cover was blown anyway. "Try and figure out how I could get my side of the story out before everything was twisted around to make me look like Nidal Hassan," Manning replied, referring to the army major who quietly became a radical Islamist and went on a shooting spree at Texas's Fort Hood in 2009, killing 13 and wounding 29. "I don't think it's going to happen," Manning added. "I mean, I was never noticed." Near the end of their series of chats, Manning seems to be contemplating more existential questions. "I'm not sure whether I'd be considered a type of hacker, cracker, hacktivist, leaker, or what," he mused. "I'm just me. Really." "Or a spy," Lamo wrote back, adding a smiling emoticon. On May 26th, less than a week into his chats with Lamo, Manning was arrested by Army criminal investigators. He was charged with more than 24 crimes, including violating the Espionage Act and aiding the enemy. The second of those crimes is punishable in the military justice system with death. But Manning's prosecutors have stated that they don't plan to argue for Manning's execution. Only a life sentence in a military prison. In March 2011, 10 months after Manning's arrest, Daniel Ellsberg stood in front of the White House wearing a navy blue suit and tie, along with hundreds of others protesting Manning's inhumane confinement in a Quantico, Virginia military jail. In July, Manning had been moved from a brig in Kuwait to the Quantico base, where he was kept with virtually no contact with other prisoners, allowed an hour of walking exercise a day, and just a few hours of visits a week. One of the few friends who managed to see him on a regular basis, a researcher at MIT named David House, describes Manning's deteriorating mental condition over the next months as a bright 23-year-old, eager to discuss physics and sociology, slowly devolved into a medicated, near-catatonic state. When House saw Manning in February, he says it was as if Manning had been sleeping hard for days and needed hours to fully wake up. At the March protest, the 79-year-old Ellsberg was asked by police to leave the street in front of the White House, as protesters chanted, "This is what hypocrisy looks like." He politely declined to leave and was put in handcuffs and taken away in a police van. When he and the other 112 arrested protesters were released later, he promptly traveled to Quantico, where he had trained as an officer in the Marines decades earlier. Outside the base there, he staged another sit-in and was arrested again. In interviews with reporters around that time, Ellsberg said that he identifies with Manning more than anyone else I've seen in the last 40 years. "I was that young man," he told a CNN reporter. "I was Bradley Manning." President Barack Obama disagrees. After a fundraising event a month later, the president was confronted by a protester doggedly asking him about Manning's confinement. Obama didn't shrink from offering his views, which were caught on camera and soon posted to YouTube. "We're a nation of laws," the president says with a smile to the Manning supporter questioning him. "We don't let individuals make their own decisions about how the laws operate. He broke the law. Isn't that just the same thing as what Daniel Ellsberg did?" Obama's interlocutor asks. "No, it wasn't the same thing," Obama responds dismissively. "Ellsberg's material wasn't classified in the same way." The president turns away, and the conversation is over. Obama is right, of course. It wasn't the same thing. The materials that Ellsberg leaked were actually of a higher top-secret classification. But the president was right on a deeper level, too. Ellsberg, despite his sympathy for Manning, is not that young man. Daniel Ellsberg's story is that ultra-rare conversion of an elite military leader into a radical dissident. Only a handful of officials had the authorization to read the Pentagon Papers. For Ellsberg to both have had the privileged access to the documents that he leaked and to actually have leaked them required a unique combination. A highly distinguished career that brought him to the pinnacle of Pentagon secrecy and a complexity of conscience that allowed him to execute a 180-degree turn in his loyalties near the peak of that career. Manning, by contrast, was one of the millions of Americans with lower-level security clearances. He fitted the profile of a leaker from the moment he entered the Pentagon's employ, disaffected, powerless, strong-willed, and anti-authority. In comparing Manning to himself, Ellsberg cites Manning's statement in his chats with Lamo that he wouldn't mind going to prison or being executed. "I never thought, for the rest of my life, I would ever hear anyone willing to do that, to risk their life, so that horrible, awful secrets could be known," Ellsberg told the CNN reporter. "Then I read those logs and learned Bradley was willing to go to prison. I can't tell you how much that affected me." But Ellsberg generously overlooks the fact that although Manning says he was willing to go to prison, he never expected to. Everything in Manning's conversations with Lamo indicates he felt that the anonymity and privacy tools he had used, along with the Army's negligent lack of security precautions, had rendered him immune from punishment. Ellsberg, by contrast, assumed he would spend much, if not the entire, rest of his life in prison, and even made practical preparations for the day when he would be separated by bars and razor wire from his wife and children. The conclusion to this story, that today Ellsberg is free while Manning is shuttled between jail cells and courtrooms to potentially face a life behind bars, might be misleading. In fact, while the technical play-by-play of each leak shows the evolution of leaking technology and methods, the outcome of those cases is a counterintuitive fluke. If not for his ill-fated conversation with Adrian Lamo, Manning's high-tech leak would likely have gone unpunished. And if not for Nixon's flubbed attacks on Ellsberg, the older man might still be in prison even 4 decades later. The barriers to modern mega-leakers like Manning have crumbled. They needn't spend a year photocopying. They needn't be Eagle Scouts or war heroes who penetrate the government's most elite layer only to go rogue. Just one of the millions of Americans with access to secret government documents, or the many, many uncountable millions more with access to secret corporate information. And perhaps most important, they needn't risk reprisal by exposing their identities to the journalists they hope will amplify their whistleblowing. The forces that caught Manning are real and significant. The greatest vulnerability for any leaker remains his or her human connections. But the lesson of Manning's story for a generation of digital natives will be, above all else, that he nearly got away with it. Use the right cryptographic tools, keep your mouth shut, and you too can anonymously, frictionlessly, eviscerate an entire institution's information. There may not be many Daniel Ellsbergs in the world ready to push through the 20th century's stubborn barriers to leaking. But the 21st century would be wise to expect more Bradley Mannings.